My name is Harold, and I'm an alcoholic.
Harold.
My home group is in Bowling Green, Kentucky. It's the Spirit of Recovery group. My sobriety date is March 31st, 1975. And I was getting kind of nervous there when Bill did that long hesitation, and I thought, "Wonder what he's going to say about me." But he did good. He did good. My wife and I. Linda, we were at a roundup at the Rough River Roundup, which is held in Kentucky twice a year. We were talking to some friends of ours, Bob and Juanita Whistle. A lot of you know them. And they had heard that Linda and I were coming over here to speak, and they just said, "You are going to love it over there. Those people are going to make you feel right at home. You're going to have a great weekend. They're going to feed you. It's just going to be a great weekend." And they were sure right on target. We've had a great weekend. Really enjoyed it. Y'all really made us feel welcome. And I'm kind of sad that this is going to end, because one thing I'm going to miss is Milton's phone calls. He called me every month for the last 6-7 months, you know. Won't know if I'm still alive and we're still going to make it. And so got to know him real well just through the phone calls. And we've run into him at several conferences over in Missouri and different places. So heard some good recovery from this podium, Brenda, last night. But that Al-Anon this morning, I tease her that she don't get it right, but... you know, she makes a good talk. She makes a talk from the heart. And she's a 14-carat lady. She really is. And I'm rough around the edges. We come from such different backgrounds. I don't know how in the world we ever got together. It had to be a God thing. And for me to end up with a woman like her is just, it just blows me away. You know, y'all are the ones that heard her share today that... you know, she grew up in a structured home, had loving grandparents, made straight A's in school, went on to college, and got that Maxwell House Award. I could just see me making a cup of coffee for a teacher when I was going to school. I mean, no, it wasn't going to happen. And so it's just... it just blows me away that we still function together. You know, I was born and raised in Bowling Green, and I hit the ground running. And it wasn't long till I was in serious trouble. I used to hobo freight trains. We lived by the railroad track, and if the train was going south, we'd go south. If the train was going north, we'd go north. Of course, that meant we weren't going to school, and the authorities didn't like that very well, the judges. And I stayed in trouble. Of course, my side of the railroad tracks had a gang. The other side of the railroad tracks had a gang. We were always fighting. And of course, there was a lot of alcohol involved. Early in my teens, alcohol was around my household. My dad was a pretty heavy drinker. And it was just accepted to drink. Of course, he didn't care much for us boys drinking his liquor, so we had to steal it. And we had a local supermarket that when the beer truck would pull up at the rear of the supermarket, and the guy would be unloading the beer into the supermarket on one side, we'd be unloading him on the other side. And then we'd go up to the local supermarket because, you know, there was always somebody in our gang had an old beat-up car, and we'd go up to the local laundromat and had those Tom's Toasted Peanut machines. And we'd just throw that in the back of the car and go to the creek and drink beer and eat peanuts and nabs. And now you do that kind of stuff very long, they frown on that. So kind of rolled along, and one of these fights that we got into, somebody got seriously hurt, and I was the prime suspect, standing in front of a judge. He's going to send me to penitentiary. So my mother convinced him somehow to let me go to the military. He said, I don't care where he goes, but you're going to get him out of my town. I want him out of here. So my mother loaded me on a train going to boot camp in the Navy with a bag of oranges and a pint of whiskey. And that's the way I went to boot camp. So when I get to boot camp, they kind of straighten my attitude up some. You know, for those of you who have been in the military, they'll straighten you up somewhat. And I was in boot camp about 2 weeks. I get a letter from home that one of my gang members, my cousin, was stabbed in the heart with an ice pick. He died before he got to the hospital. So if I'd have been home, there had to have been some revenge for that, for sure. So if circumstances had been different, you'd probably have a different speaker standing up here tonight, if I would still be alive, you know. Until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just stayed one step ahead of death, just one step ahead of death, in and out of jails. I didn't know my grandparents or my grandfathers, never met them, and so my home life wasn't very structured. And so anyway, before I get too far in, I want to, you know, I'm sure there's other fellowships and other places in our society that a person can go learn about a spiritual way of life and how to live that spiritual way of life. But this is the only place that I have found that fits my needs. Because in this spiritual way of life, in this fellowship, y'all keep reinforcing the fact that I'm still an alcoholic, and alcohol is poison to an alcoholic. That's what y'all talk about in these meetings. And you tell me the only way I can stay away from that first drink is through a spiritual condition that is maintained through working those steps. Now, I'm sure in these other fellowships, if I kind of got off and went with them, I could probably live a spiritual life, but I'd probably be driving down the road with one of these other spiritual persons, and they might be one of those people that can drink with impunity that the book talks about. And they might say, let's stop and have a drink. And I'll say, fine. And they take that drink and go home. I take that drink and I'm off and running. So that's why this fellowship is so important to me. And it fits all of my needs. And I've had so many spiritual experiences since I've been in this program. And it's real obvious when you see it happen in other people's lives, especially the people you sponsor. I had one guy that really stands out to me. I picked him up, I started sponsoring him about 10 years ago. And he was from the same side of tracks that I was born on, rough, fight, all that. And one of his brothers was a known drug dealer in Bowling Green. And he was a pretty smart drug dealer. He didn't use those drugs, he just sold them. So this big drug deal went down and it didn't go well. So this guy's brother got killed. Well, he knew the guy that killed him. So when I started sponsoring this guy, when we got to that fourth step, I said, I want you to make a grudge list. Guess who was at the top of that list? This guy. He had hate in him. I mean, that's all he could talk about was getting this guy to kill his brother. And I knew right off the bat we were going to have to do some work, a lot of work, because the book says resentment will kill us. It will kill us. So we started working on this fourth step, and we're going down there. We get it completed, and we get on down to the eighth step. And he makes out his eighth step list, and he brings it to me, and he said, hey, what about this? I said, well, where's the guy that killed your brother? And, I mean, he just got angry at me. He said, why would that guy have to be on my men's list? I said, because you hate him so much. You owe him amends for hating him so much. He said, I don't agree with that one bit. I said, well, we're going to have to work on it. So we worked and we worked. Now, this guy that killed his brother was in the penitentiary for life. So I told this guy's sponsor, I said, what this means is when we get to step 9, you're going to have to be willing, if the opportunity ever comes up that you encounter this guy that killed your brother, you're going to have to make amends to him. He said, okay. So I went to a meeting one morning, And I go through the door, and this guy's sponsor, he's standing in the doorway, and he's just shaking like a leaf. And I said, what in the world's wrong with you? He said, he's here. I said, who's here? The guy that killed my brother. And I thought, oh, my God, he's out of prison? I mean, you know, I just thought, uh-oh. So I said, you know what we got to do? So we started around the table. The guy sitting over against the wall just got out of prison. They told him he needed to start going to AA. He'd been in AA in prison. We get within about 10 feet of this guy, and this guy throws his hand up, and he said, hold it. He said, my parole officer said, I can't be within certain footage of you or anybody in your family. I said, hold it, dog. We're over here for a different reason. Just calm down. I told the guy's sponsor, I said, okay. Well, the tears started flowing. I mean, he just couldn't control it. Tears started flowing. And he looked at this guy and he said, as hard as it is in my heart, I forgive you for killing my brother. This guy right out of prison, you could just see the weight fall off of his shoulders. I mean, just whew. And his tears started falling. And he said, you know, I didn't know what I was going to encounter when I got out of prison from you or your family. He said, you don't know how much this means to me for you to come over to me like this. They got up and hugged each other. And the tears were just falling. I got goosebumps. Now, to this day, this guy I sponsored, don't mention this guy anymore. He's gone. The forgiveness is there. The resentment is gone. Now, if that's not power of a program that can do anything, I don't know what is. So, I mean, I saw that firsthand. And like I say, when you see it going on in somebody else's life, it really stands out. Now, about a month ago, my wife, she's the Kentucky State Al-Anon delegate, and I get to follow her to Virginia Beach every year, lay on the beach while she's in all these meetings. So I take my laptop with me, and I'm checking my emails and checking the local news of Bowling Green. And the headline news in Bowling Green was this 21-year-old girl had been murdered. And she had met, this 21-year-old girl had met this woman on Facebook. And this woman befriended her, and this young girl was 8 months pregnant. So they were talking back and forth on Facebook, and the young girl told this woman that she was in need of some baby clothing and stuff like that for this baby she's going to have. So this woman said, well, I believe I can hook you up with somebody that can meet your needs. So we'll meet. Well, when they met, this woman took her out in the field, took a knife, cut her throat, cut her open, took her baby. Took the baby to the local hospital in Bowling Green and told the attending nurses, said, I just had this baby. I want you to check it out and make sure it's okay. And they said, well, fine. I said, well, why don't you get up on the table and let us check you, being that you just had this baby. Of course, they checked the woman, said, you haven't had a baby. They called the state police. State police show up, and she fessed up that she killed this girl. I sponsor this girl's father. So, what do you say to somebody like that? What can you say to help ease that pain? The only thing I knew to do was to do what y'all taught me in this program. Get him busy. Don't let him sit in that pain. Because I knew that grieving that he was going through, it wouldn't be long till it turned to hate. And when it turned to hate, it was going to eat a hole in him. And I was going to do everything within my power, me and some other AA members up there, to keep that from happening. And he's doing fine today. He's still hurting a lot. But we got him busy. We got him busy. And, you know, and the so-called normal people were telling him things like, oh, you know, maybe it's God's will, or she's in a better place. You know, my book don't tell me that kind of stuff. You know. So I've seen great adversity overcome by the principles of this program. And it just blows me away that the way it works. So, and you know, when I first got here, I'd hear about, of course, I was probably as agnostic as anybody else. And y'all were talking about God's grace this, and God's grace that. Well, in my mind, the only people that had God's grace were the people that frequented places like this, churches. You had to earn it. God's grace had to be earned. And I was really fortunate to have some good sponsors that told me that's not the case. God's grace is free. It's just for the asking. Just accept it. It's there. And he told me things like, y'all have heard in the meetings, you know, you can have your own conception of God, your own understanding of God. And I fired right back at him. I said, that won't work for me. I said, the understanding I've got for God, No, I think Brenda kind of shared that last night too in her talk, that the conception of God I had was a punishing God, a God you had to fear. And he looked at me and he said, I guess we're just going to have to start at ground zero here and start unlearning a lot of stuff. And we did just that. So I've got a conscious relationship with a God of my understanding today, a powerful God. And you know, I hear things in meetings that sometimes I don't agree with, and I hear people share from time to time that, you know, they say if you want potatoes, you better get a hoe or you better get a shovel, that God's not going to do for you what you can do for yourself. Well, I have to disagree with that, because the book tells me that we have to go from using God as a pinch hitter to a full-time manager. Now, the best jobs I've ever had in my life, in my sobriety, have come by turning it over. Not getting the hole in the shovel, turning it over. Relationships, turning it over. Everything has just seemed like it's falling in my lap. I remember I was working a job one time that I really hated. And I was driving 50 miles each way to this job. And I told Linda, I said, you know, I really hate this job. It's just ruining my health. And I just prayed about it. One Sunday morning, I'm reading the local news newspaper up there in Bowling Green, which I didn't read that much because I didn't like reading it. Something told me to open up to the want ads. I don't know where it came from, so I just followed directions. There was this big ad in there, this job opening at this plant, 2 blocks from my house. I filled out an application, resume, sent it in. 300 people went over there for interviews. They wasn't going to hire but 3. I just turned it over. I went to work over there. I wasn't qualified for the job. I was not qualified for that job. I had to humble myself to have these guys already working there teach me. Teach me what was going on. I just turned it over. So I just don't try to say, God, I'll handle this one. You can handle the next one. It just don't seem to work that way with me. So, but anyway, I went in the Navy, and I got in a lot of trouble in the Navy and got 2 court martials, came out of there, and it wasn't long. I was standing back in front of judges. Wrecked every automobile I ever owned until I got sober. And I just couldn't seem to stay awake when I was drinking and driving. It just seemed impossible. I remember one time, and I'm not going to share much of my drunk log, but I lived about 110 miles from Louisville. I'd been up in Louisville partying all weekend. Sunday afternoon, it was after dark. I'm drunk. That little vague thought in the back of my head, you know, it says, I need to get back home so I can go to work on Monday. It was back there, that little vague thought. So I start back home on the I-65, which is an interstate highway. And they had toll booths on this interstate highway back then. So I'm rolling down the interstate and doing about 70, I guess. Blacked out. Well, when I came to, there's this toll booth right in front of me. And I thought, oh, crap. you know. So I slide through it sideways. The lights go off and the whistles and bells. I hit the median. I come back across. I come through this side. Bells and lights go off. I pulled up there. Of course, I'm full of alcohol. I don't have any fear. This guy comes walking out of the toll booth, and he's shaking. He's shaking all over. I rolled my window down. I said, man, that's close, wasn't it? And I said, well, I guess I need to be going. And the toll was 50 cents. I said, what do I owe you? He said, well, this is your third time through here. You owe me a dollar and a half. Funny now, wasn't back then. But so anyway, I drank and I was in my 20s, late 20s, and my liver started acting up on me pretty bad. Went to a doctor there in Louisville. And he got to pressing around on my liver, and of course it didn't feel good. He told me that I was going to die if I didn't quit drinking. Asked me why I drank. Now, you know, that's this woman that don't understand me. I was my first wife. She don't understand me. These unruly kids, employers that don't understand me, and you know. But I used to carry a half pint of whiskey in each boot to go to work, but they didn't understand me. See. And I went on and on about why I drank so much. And of course, I lied to him about how much I drank. But he said, I'm going to tell you, you're going to die if you don't quit it. Went on for a while longer. Now, I had an older brother that had moved from California to Memphis. He was a career Navy man, and he was working on 20 years. Had a little drinking problem. The Navy told him, said, you got to do something about this drinking problem. You're not going to make it to 20. We're going to kick you out. So he sobers up. All right, I'm sitting in Louisville, and I can't buy a job. Because like I say, all the contractors up there, I work construction then. And they knew me. I was a drunk. But my wife at that time says, why don't you call your brother in Memphis and see, or call your business agent and see if you can get a job in Memphis. Your brother had just moved there from California. Well, I didn't understand her reasoning because me and brother, when we got together, we were going to jail. He drank just like I did. I said, fine. Yeah, that sounded like a good idea to me. So I load up some clothes and I get my old wrecked car. I got my fifth between my legs and I'm headed for Memphis. And I get to Memphis and I pull up in the driveway where my brother's supposed to live. And it didn't look like a place he lived. The house was painted, yard was mowed, there was a garden in the backyard, swing set for the kids. It looked like a family lived there. That wasn't my brother. So I get my fifth and I walk in the door. I said, let's have a drink, brother. He said, nah, he said, I don't drink anymore. I said, what's the matter? You got the flu? There's got to be something wrong with you. You don't drink anymore. So I go into the table and set my bottle up there on the table. He goes in the back room and he comes back with this book. Sets it between me and my bottle. Well, I know what that first word means. I've never seen that other word used too much. I knew what that first word meant. And I mean, the hair just bristled on the back of my neck. I said, what are you insinuating here? And he said, oh, nothing. He said, that's one of the best things that ever happened in my life right there, this book. And he said, do me a favor. He said, you can stay here till you get on your feet. He said, just read this book. Just read it. I said, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. So I lay in the bed, in the bedroom, and I'd sip on my whiskey, and I'd read this book. And the drunker I got, the better it sounded. Man, some neat stuff. Well, I went back to Louisville and got my wife and brought her to Memphis. And my brother's wife was in Al-Anon. They started working on her, getting her in Al-Anon. And they pulled her in. So they start working on me. They say, just go to one AA meeting. Just go to one and see what it's about. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone. One Saturday morning, I get up and I start drinking early like I usually did. By that afternoon, about 6, 7 o'clock, I'm feeling good. Fear's gone. I'm ready for anything. I said, told my wife, I said, you call that brother of mine. You tell him I'll go to one of those daggone meetings. But I'm going to tell you something right now. When I get there, if anybody says anything to me out of the way, I'm going to make a scene. I'm going to embarrass every one of you. You get that? They said, sure, fine. They throw me in the car and take me to the Action Club in Memphis, I believe it was. This was back in 1970, 75. So I walk in. I got a T-shirt on, blue jeans, and my boots, and I'm drunk. Oh, I'm drunk. I look around and I start judging everybody. What I see is all these men standing there with these three-piece suits on, a tie, diamonds on every finger, good-looking woman on their arms, and a Cadillac in a parking lot. I thought, heck, if I had all that, I wouldn't drink either. But if you had my problems, you'd drink like I do. Yeah, I was judging them. I was judging them. So I heard a speaker, just like I'm doing tonight, got up and shared. And I could identify, as drunk as I was, I could identify with a lot of what this speaker was saying. So, messed around, lost a job there in Memphis, and I had to move back to Bowling Green, live with my mom and dad. And I kind of nursed myself off of that drunk, and I had that book my brother gave me. So I'm living with my mother and dad, and I thought, you know, I might go to some of those AA meetings, just see what it's all about. So I started going to meetings there in Bowling Green. And I'd be sitting in my mom and dad's living room. I'd be reading that book, and my dad'd be sitting across the room. He'd be about half drunk. He'd look over at me. He said, you know what? He said, you ain't nothing but a daggone disgrace to our family. Going to those meetings down there. Everybody knows who goes to those meetings. Nothing but drunks. You're not a drunk. You're not an alcoholic. You just need to learn how to drink like the rest of us. So, Papa, I've tried it. It's killing me, drinking like the rest of us. But that was his impression of an alcoholic. Under the bridge, skid rows. Well, I'm going to these meetings, and I made maybe four meetings. This woman comes up to me one night, and she says, we used to use a little 24-hour day book, that little Hazleton book. She hands me one of those books, and she said, here, I'm going to be your sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? And she went on spilling out what a sponsor is, and she said, I want you to read that book every morning when you get up. I said, good, good. I said, you really sound like you know a lot about this program. I said, how long have you been sober? She said, 90 days. Now, here I am, new in AA. I got me a woman sponsor with 90 days sober. We both got drunk. We both got drunk. And I finished that drunk up with my dad. And I never will forget my mother getting me out of bed and trying to get an ounce of whiskey down me to keep me from going into DTs. Getting me to the bathroom, and I mean stuff coming out of both ends. And then she'd run into the bedroom where my dad was, and she'd point at him and say, this is your fault. This is your fault. You taught him all this. And I'd say, that's right. I'm just carrying on a family tradition. That's right. Well, she nursed me off of that drunk well enough to where I could get in my car and drive back to Memphis. And this time I didn't have that jug between my legs. I was whipped. I was whipped. And I was at that stage where most alcoholics can relate to. Alcohol just wasn't working. It just wasn't taking me where it used to. Just that stupor. The more you drank, it seemed like you wasn't going anywhere, you know. And that's a horrible place to be. Horrible place to be. And let me tell you a quick little story before I go on. Me and Linda, we was flying back from Virginia Beach. I was sitting next to these two brothers that had been over, they lived outside of Nashville. And they'd been over to Virginia Beach, they were young guys. They'd been over there for 4 days throwing a bachelor party for their other brother that lived in Virginia Beach. Now, these boys had been partying for 4 solid days, and they were sick. Boy, they'd throw their head back on the seat, and they'd come forward. Oh, I mean, you know, we all been there. Just sick. And I'm looking at them, I think, oh, man, I'm glad I'm not where you guys are. So they was telling me how they was partying, all that stuff, you know, and I thought one of them was going to just puke all over me. But the stewardess comes down to the aisle on the airplane. And I'm looking at these guys like, I know they're going to get a drink. They're going to order a drink. They got to. I mean, they're dying. They're sick. stewardess comes by and asked them if they wanted anything to drink, and they said, no. I said, you guys not going to get you anything to make you well? We don't want to see that out. We don't want to see alcohol for a long time. I thought, these are normal drinkers. Because if that had been me, I'd have given that stewardess a $100 bill, and I'd say, you keep it coming till I get well. I said, I'm looking at two normal drinkers. One of them had to go to work that night. He said, we ain't going to do this for a long, long time. You see, that's the difference. The difference in alcoholic in a normal drinker. But anyway, I get back to Memphis, and I'm shaking like a leaf. I mean, I am shaking, and I go to this meeting. It was at Raleigh Fraser. I fell in there, and I had a cup of coffee, and I couldn't even hold it. I was shaking so bad. Didn't want to look up because I was afraid somebody would look back at me. And I just happened to glance and look up on the wall, and they had some quotes out of the big book on this up on the wall. It said, no one has been too discredited or has sunk too low to be welcome in this program. There's no dues, there's no fees, there's no lectures to be endured. The only requirement is, hopefully, a desire to stop drinking. And I thought to myself, I wonder if they really mean that. I wonder if they really mean that. Because if they do, it's unlike any other place I've ever been. They don't expect anything of me other than hopefully I want to stop drinking. Well, for the most part, that's been true. That's been true. Now, here was the kicker. Down in Memphis, they appointed me a sponsor. They didn't give me a chance to pick me another woman sponsor. And it's guys like me that probably got that started about men sponsor men, women sponsor women. So, now this sponsor was an old-timer, and he just put it on the line to me. He said, here's a meeting schedule. He said, I want you to make these meetings. He said, I'm not going to come and get you. You call me. If you call me, I'll come and get you and take you and get you familiar where these meetings are. But I'm not going to make it a habit to come pick you up, because if you wanted a drink, you'd hitchhike, you'd steal a bicycle, you'd get that drink, right? And I said, yeah, I have. I've done just that. These meetings are just as important as that first drink. Get that in your head now. These meetings are that important. And he said, I want you to stay out of wet places. You still got alcoholic thinking? You don't need to be going in those places. He was firm with me. So we start getting in this book. And I don't know about y'all, but I owed everybody and their brother money. And they want it now. So I told this sponsor, you know, after about 2 or 3 months, I stopped shaking. Started feeling pretty good. I told this sponsor, I said, look here. I said, I got a lot of pressure on me. I said, I got people I owe money to, and I need to get me a job. I got me another job in Memphis, 40-hour job. I said, I need to get me a job where I can make a lot of money quick, where I can pay these people off, and then we'll start working on this spiritual thing you're talking about here. He said, oh, no, 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 no. He said, you got it backwards. We need to grow spiritually, and all this other stuff will take care of itself in due time. I said, I can't take you up on this one. Well, I quit that job in Memphis, go all the way up to Kansas City, Missouri. Sure enough, I was working construction, and found me a job working 7 days a week, working as many hours you wanted to put in. They'd let you stay there all night if you wanted to. Making the money. Stacking it up. But guess what happened? My attitude got, well, it was real bad. Real bad. The drink was right around the corner. Something told me one night to take off early and go to a meeting downtown Kansas City. Walked into a discussion meeting. And they got to sharing around the meeting, and they said, you got anything to share? And I shared what was going on with me, what my sponsor had told me and all this. I told him I just felt miserable. I just felt out of it. So one of these old-timers grabbed me at the meeting and said, come on, I want to show you something. Took me further downtown Kansas City, Missouri, and went down in the Salvation Army. There was about 20 or 30 cots down there with Skid Row drunks on these cots. You see, this is one of the places I come for gratitude. He said, one of these could be me. One of these could be you. And he said, I talked to these guys. And I bring them cigarettes, whatever, when they need them. And he said, but this is gratitude for me right here. And he looked at me and he said, how long do you say you've been sober? And I said, you know, it's a few months. He said, you get yourself back to Memphis, back to that sponsor, and you do what he tells you to do. So I go back to Memphis, couldn't find a job, so I had to move out of Memphis, went over to Hendersonville, Tennessee. Got active in the program. Got me a sponsor, started working, getting in this book. So, sponsor told me, says, we need to start working a fourth step. I said, okay. He said, I want you to make me a grudge list. He was pretty shrewd. He didn't spell out the whole fourth step to me. He said, I want you to make me a grudge list. I said, grudge list? He said, yeah. People you got resentments toward and all this stuff. I said, no problem. No problem. I got me a pad and the pen was flowing. Going by the graph in there, the chart. And I mean, it was just flowing, what these people had done to me. When I was 21 years old, I went to a psychiatrist because there were some people thought I was nuts. And they was hoping this psychiatrist would figure out why I drank so much. And I remember before these sessions would be over, he had me back in my childhood, and I really felt like a victim. And, this psychiatrist was, oh, poor thing, and, you had a rough childhood and all this stuff. I felt like a victim. Well, I felt the same way when I took this list back to my sponsor. He's going to see why I drank so much. My sponsor's going to see, look here. Oh, yeah, man, I can see why you drank. Uh-uh. No. He looked at it, he said, that's good. He said, now we're going to go on to the rest of the steps. The rest of the fourth step. He said, now I want you to list your fears, things you wouldn't tell anybody. Whew, rough. Going into that sex inventory and all that stuff. So this fourth step that I was so proud of to begin with, I started hiding in my trunk under my spare tire. That's where I kept my inventory while I was putting it together. And then I had the fear that somebody might rear end me. My trunk lid would fly open and my inventory would go all over the street. I mean, I had a fear. Somebody getting a hold of this inventory. Now, I didn't even take my fifth step with my sponsor. As a matter of fact, I was working a job down here in Chattanooga, right outside of Chattanooga at Saudi Daisy. There's a nuclear plant over there. And I took my fifth step with a guy on Signal Mountain. Dumped it. What a relief. What a relief it was. Especially when the man sat there and didn't judge me. Even related to some of the things I'd done, he said he had done. I mean, what a weight off of my shoulders. Now, I've done several four steps since then with my sponsors because I trust them. But I had this fear of early on, what am I going to do if this sponsor gets drunk and he gets running in his mouth? Fear. But anyway, I got back in Hendersonville me and another guy and a couple other guys, we started a new group, really, really getting active. Now, me and my first wife, we still wasn't gee-hawing just right, still at each other. And the old-timers were saying, look, you two, there's a chapter in the big book called The Family Afterwards. Y'all need to read that. It goes into detail what y'all are going through. I said, not me. I'm fine. What else could this woman want from me? I'm working every day. I'm not drinking. She needs to read it, but not me. Well, we kept messing around, and we ended up divorced. And I never will forget, she telling me, when we walked out of that lawyer's office, she said, you'll be drunk before nightfall. You need me to stay sober. I said, really? I probably stayed sober that first year on resentment. I was going to show her I didn't need her to stay sober. But I did. I managed to stay. I mean, it was painful in the beginning, going through that divorce. And we had two children. Actually, we had three children. And so I took whatever I got out of that divorce, material stuff, and I bought me a travel trailer. And I thought, when I was drinking and I was traveling all over the country, there was always a bar waiting on me that I could find to get me a drink. I said, the same applies to AA. Wherever I go is going to be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I did. I took this travel trailer, put everything I owned in it. I go all over the country meeting people in AA. Had a good life. And I never forget, I was coming up on about, I'd already met Linda, but I was coming up on about 7 years of sobriety. And my brother, one of my brother's wife called me and said, your brother's really getting in bad shape with this drinking. Said, you think maybe you can get him into whatever you're in? Do something about his drinking. I was Mr. AA. I said, no problem. I said, I was on my way to Arizona to a job out there. I had my travel trailer hooked up, my truck, and I was ready to go. I said, throw him in the truck. I said, I'll have him sober in 30 days. Well, we're going on our way to Arizona, and we stopped at, I'd stop to fill up gas. He'd get him some beer, and he'd hang them on my mirrors. You know, we're driving down the road, and he's listening to George Jones. He stopped loving her today all the way to Arizona, drinking. I'm getting a little uneasy. We get set up in Arizona in Phoenix. And I start making meetings. I'm going to meetings. I said, come on, go to a meeting with me, brother. Nah, I don't believe I want to. I come home from the meeting back to my trailer, and he'd have half of the bar in my trailer. Well, then I started acting like an Al-Anon. I'd take a broom and just run them out. And I'd say, you know, you need to do something about this drinking. So Easter time was coming up. He said, bro, I want to fly home for Easter. Getting kind of homesick. I said, okay, I'm going to take you to the airport. And I put that Al-Anon finger on him. I said, I'm going to tell you, when you come back, you better be sober. Now, come on. How many times I had a finger stuck in my face? You better be sober. And I told him, don't come back drunk. Well, he gets back, and I go pick him up at the airport. He always wore a cowboy. He's kind of like punk over. He always wore a cowboy hat. And he promised the landlady where we had the trailer parked a country ham. So I see him coming down the hallway off the plane. He got that country ham under one arm, and he's hitting both sides of the wall. He's drunk. I mean, he can't hardly walk. My heart just fell. So we go down to get his baggage. You know that revolving belt that the baggage comes around on? He reached to get his bag and he fell right on it. Here he goes. I said, that's it. I'm taking you home. I loaded the trailer up and I took him home. I couldn't do anything with him. So I saw right then what you people were telling me in the meetings. You can't force people to get sober. And it's harder on when you're trying to do it with your family. You know, we got a lady back home said, you sober my kids up and I'll sober yours up. That's the way it's got to work, you know. So I took him back home, and his wife threatened to put him in jail or something. He got sober, stayed sober 13 years without going to one AA meeting. And she got so miserable living with him sober, she divorced him. Dry drunk, 13 years. Can you imagine that? Oh. Well, anyway, he went back to drinking. Now, 2 years ago, October, you know, the doctors kept telling him to quit drinking because he was starting to develop liver problems like me. And it got so bad they had to go in and bandage his esophagus because he'd rupture. He'd lose a lot of blood. So they'd take him in, they'd patch him up. Don't drink anymore. Listen to us. He'd go right back to drinking. I'd take him back to the hospital. I said, you know, look, brother, this is bad here. I know, brother. So the last time, of course, now, you know, my dad had already died. Of course, he'd go over there to my mom and dad's and drink with them. And they had no idea that the first drink is the one that gets you. You know, they didn't know that when they would buy him one drink, that wasn't the end of it. That there was going to be another run to the hospital. Last time he was in the hospital, he's in the bed, and every time he would cough, enough blood would come out of him. I mean, it would just flood the whole bed. My mother's standing right there beside of me. Of course, they're giving him transfusions, and finally they come in and said, we can't waste any more blood. It's over. It's over. Watched him lay there and bleed to death. Bleed to death. And my mother and my brother looked up when he'd come to, you know, in between pain shots. And he said, bro, what happened? What happened, bro? That's not a good time to lecture somebody. You could have joined AA. You could have done something about this. You didn't have to die. Sit there and watched it. Watched him just waste away. He was a year younger than me. I got such a resentment toward my mother. I had to really talk to my sponsor strong about that lifestyle. You know, I really blamed her for his death for a while. And my sponsor said, you can't do that. You can't do that. That's your mother. You know, so I finally worked through that. Now, my older brother, the one that planted the seed for me in Memphis, he went back to drinking. Now, he got his 20-year retirement. He got a job as a union millwright. They make good money. He worked long enough to get a pension. Now, he's drinking all along. Retired over in Paris, Tennessee with some of his working buddies, and they started making moonshine. Now, they wasn't making it to sell it. They was making it to drink it. They'll get a call one night. He's dead. Drank yourself to death. So me and Linda, my oldest son, we go down there, claim the body, start making some arrangements. So I get to checking around with his finances, his union pension, his Navy pension, his Social Security, and all this stuff. He had given it to all his drinking buddies. His pensions, I didn't have enough money to put him in the ground. We had to hold a yard sale to come up with enough money to bury him. And his drinking buddies would come around doing the yard sale and say, well, you know, old Murph wanted me to have this. Old Murph wanted me to have that. And I said, I'll tell you what, you put a hand on that, and I'll show you what this Murph will do for you. I mean, that's just, you know, that's alcoholism. Had two daughters up in Minnesota. He didn't even know they existed. We got him buried. Had enough ex-wives to be pallbearers. Had six ex-wives. That's the kind of family I come from. You know, Dad died. My dad died. He'd drink beer and take Xanax by the handful. Crawl up in the bed in the fetal position. That's where he stayed till he died. I broke the family tradition. I broke it. As Linda shared with you this morning, we got six kids, 15 grandkids. Now, except for the older ones that lived through my drinking years, you know, they depend on us. I'm there when they need me. And you know, early on in my sobriety, I had people betting against me staying sober. They say, he'll never make it. You know, people that knew me, he ain't going to make it. He's going to drink again. That hurt my feelings. Now that I got 36 years, there's people say, oh, you'll never get drunk again. That hurts my feelings. They take my sobriety for granted. You know, that's just crazy thinking. I'm responsible for my own sobriety. It's my sobriety. I can't get into that kind of stuff. What do you think about my sobriety? It don't matter. It's mine, you see. So I'm rolling along. I meet Linda. She said I was having some dental work done, met her. We just kind of clicked. I introduced her to my AA friends. She just fell in love with them. I mean, we had more fun. She said, I've never seen a group of people have this much fun not drink. So they fell in love with her too. So it progressed along. So she said, I lived out of this clothes basket, which I did. You know, I worked construction. I might be going off on a job or something. She'd come home working, that clothes basket would be gone. She knew I was gone. Well, we did this back and forth, and she had a bad car wreck. She didn't share that this morning. She had a bad car wreck and about killed her. And you know, the thought hit me when I heard about the car wreck. I thought, you know, I really love her, and life is just too short. I thought, if she'll marry me, I'm going to ask her to marry me, because she was a decent woman. So I called her, and I said, yeah, I got a solution for our situation. Let's go get married. And we did. So we go and we're standing in front of this preacher. She's got her arm in a sling and she's got 80 stitches across her forehead. This preacher's looking at us like, what in the world? You know, what happened to you? I mean, but we had some friends went down there with us when we got married, and it was just a simple deal. So, and she shared this morning that I said, we need to go somewhere where nobody knows us. Well, what I meant, what happened is, I told her, we need to go somewhere where nobody can touch us. Because my ex-wife, when she found out we got married, the pressure was on. She wanted Linda to see the other side of me. She wanted Linda to see the drunk side. So she started dragging me to court and suing me for money I didn't owe her, and she had a slicker lawyer than I did. So things starting to spiral down. And like I said, we loaded up and went to Texas. I got a job down there, and I'm making meetings, and of course she's not in Al-Anon yet. Now, all this stuff falling in on me, I'm not using my sponsor. I had everything in this big book underlined because I'd read it so many times, you know, solutions to life in this book. But it's to be used with a sponsor. Well, I'm thinking in my mind, I've got 9 years of sobriety. I got my own answers. I don't need to run this by my sponsor because, number one, I don't want people to know I got problems with this length of sobriety. In my sick mind, I thought I was an old-timer at 9 years. So I'm sitting in the meetings in Texas, and in Texas, when you share, you give your name and your sobriety date, and then you start sharing. I told him, I said, I started sharing. I said, my name's Harold, and I'm an alcoholic. Been sober since March 31st, 1975. And everything from that point on was how the world was dumping on me. Just dumping on me. How miserable I was. So it goes around the table. Guy sitting across the table from me, he'd been sober about 3 years, you know, newcomer. And he told his name and his sobriety date, and he looked over at me and he said, you know what? He said, if I ever get 9 years of sobriety, he said, I hope I'm nothing like you. Well, he could have just reached across the table and smacked me, not hurt me any worse than saying something like that to me. I mean, my ego was just, oh. All right. So I knew something had to change. And I'd had a friend in Hendersonville, Tennessee, that one of the guys that we started a group together. And he got in a situation that threatened his sobriety. It was pretty bad. Lost his house, lost his business, everything going down the tubes. And he came to Bowling Green, and he told me he was going to this treatment center. He looked bad. He hadn't drank, but he looked bad. He said, I'm going to this treatment center over in North Carolina. And he said, I'm just burnt out. Don't know what to do. So he goes to this treatment center, comes back 30 days. He looked brand new. I mean, it looked like they took him, wrung him out. So he gives me this card of this treatment center, and he says, you know, if you ever really get in a situation where things are rough, you might want to think about this. I said, okay, so I stored it away. So Linda shared about this friend from Bowling Green came to Texas and stopped by to see us, and we walked the beach and we talked, and I told him, I thought, you know, I had this friend who went to this treatment center, and I saw him, and it looked like it really did him some good. I'm thinking about going over. He said, well, you need to go. So she got everything arranged, called the insurance company, and they said, yeah, let him go, and put me on the plane. So I get to this place over in Fayetteville, North Carolina. I get off the plane. Now, I think in my mind that I'm going to a treatment center for old-timer alcoholics that are burnt out. So they take me to the treatment center, and this doctor interviews me. He said, how long has it been since you've had your last drink or drunk? I said, 9 years. Well, he's recording all this stuff. I'm telling him. He said, what do you hope to accomplish over here? I said, man, look. Now, see, a lot of the problem in our marriage at that time is I hadn't had an opportunity to fully make amends to my kids by my first wife. Now, here I was living with a new wife that had two kids by her previous marriage, plus the child we had. And the guilt and remorse was eating me alive. Because those kids from that first marriage had seen me at my worst. I really need to make some living amends, not a card on their birthday. Living amends. She didn't know what was going on inside of me. She thought it was her. And I had got to a point where I was blaming her. You know, wasn't for you. Maybe I could be up there making amends to those kids. You know, she was an obstacle. But I mean, I didn't tell her that, but you know, this is what was going on in this sick mind of mine. So I'm telling this doctor all this remorse and guilt and all that stuff I'm carrying. And I said, this is what I think. I need to do another four step and this. I still had all my answers. Doctor said, fine. They put me out in this group, about 30 people sitting around in a circle. And I look over and their heads are bobbing. These people right out of detox. I want to raise my hand and say, hey, you got me in the wrong group. I'm supposed to be with old timers, wherever they're at. This counselor walks in, this woman. And she put her hands behind her back and she said, group, so we got a new member. He said, if anybody in here has got any guilt and remorse and just garbage that they need somebody to carry for them for a long time, he'll do it. Well, I'm getting kind of nervous because that's what I told this doctor. I'm thinking, man, surely she's not talking about me. And she kept on and on about this new member. Finally, she comes over and she grabs me up out of my chair. And she says, now, group, I want to introduce our new member. She said, his name is Jesus Christ. She said, get up here on your cross, Jesus. Threw me up in the middle of that floor like I'm on a cross. Well, man, I'm turning red-faced. I'm humiliated. I said, I'm getting out of here. I didn't pay good money to come over and be treated like this. Well, what they were trying to do was break my ego. They're trying to break me down, get me back to basics. This other counselor walks in, this man, and she said, look at our new member, Jesus, up on his cross. Don't he look good? Don't he look good? Says, he'll just carry anything, anybody, any burdens anybody's got for a long time. Said, you got any suggestions for Jesus? Of course, I had my jeans and my boots on, and I'm standing there, and he said, yeah. He said, I think he's a little bit too big for those britches. Said, I think he ought to wear somebody's pants that's three or four sizes bigger than his for the next week. No. I'm getting out of here. So he comes over to me, and he looks me square in the eye, and he said, you didn't like that, did you? I said, no, I didn't. He said, you'll either do it or you'll leave. I thought, man, I'm between a rock and a hard place here. He said, you're going to do it. Well, just so happened my roommate was four sizes bigger than me. They made me ask him if I could borrow a pair of his pants, made me humble myself. Well, here I am wearing these big pants, and I've got strings and everything holding them up. They put us in vans to take us to meetings like they do most of these treatment centers. And I just know that I'm going to run into somebody from Bowling Green, Kentucky, and see me in these big pants. I mean, ego is... But you know what? These people right out of detox, they saw how much pain I was in, how humiliated I was, and they just kind of formed a circle around me. And of course, these counselors took me back through the steps. The majority of the counselors over there were recovering alcoholics. And they saw they had a tough nut on their hands. They had to break me. Well, I made it through that week with those big pants, and I'm starting to come back down, back to what y'all have taught me. Now, I'm not saying that I couldn't have done the same thing with another sponsor. I don't know. Probably could have. But that's just the way it came down. So I get out of this treatment. I really hated to leave. My attitude was right on track. So I get home, found out that my insurance wasn't going to pay for this little visit over there because I hadn't relapsed. So we owed them a lot of thousands on that one. But I didn't care. I was in such a state of mind. I was back to where y'all had taken me early in my sobriety. So I get back home, and she picks me up at the airport, and she could see I was a different person. I told her, let's just give it one more shot. And maybe I did say, I need you. Maybe I did say that. And she said, okay. So we get back, we go to Texas. And she told me, I want it this way, this way, and this way. You know, more travel trailer, and and hurt my feeling when she sold my travel trailer. I didn't think she'd get that kind of money out of it, but she did. Well, she finally breaks down and starts Al-Anon. And I loved her sponsor, because when she'd call her sponsor and say, he's not doing this and he's doing that and blah, 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 she said, I don't give a crap what he's doing. I want to hear about you. I loved her. She kept her right on track. And they started a love relationship in Al-Anon, and she started growing, and we started getting along. And my ex-wife finally figured out she wasn't going to get me drunk. And so, of course, Linda said that I came to her one day and said, we need to go back to Bowling Green. You know, I needed to get back around those kids from my first marriage. And we moved back to Bowling Green and went to work there. Started making these living amends with these kids. Today we've got a great relationship. I've got a great relationship with my kids and with her kids. You know, they're not her kids, my kids, and then our only one. They're all ours. You know, we worked this program, and of course she told you about the problem we have with the one son that is ours, that we thought would be the only one that wouldn't have a problem with drugs and alcohol. And it was bad there for a while. And like she said, we left him in jail for 14 days. And the company he worked for, they just loved him to death. I mean, he was just a fun kid. And they thought we were such bad parents, they was taking up a collection at work to get him out of jail. Well, they couldn't understand why parents would leave their son in jail. Well, as she shared, his employer, or his the guy that owned the company, ended up in Al-Anon about a year later with their son, problems with their son. And he said, I understand now. I understand the tough love that y'all had to do with this boy. But, you know, it was tough going, because when he got arrested, state troopers come over my house, wanted to look in the trunk of his car. We opened it up, looked like Fort Knox. I never seen as many guns in my life. They don't tell him what he was into. But we just had to keep working that program. Now, one of the boys that got in trouble with him, of course, his parents went down and they mortgaged their house and got him a high-powered lawyer. And, you know, poor baby, took him home. Our son, I took him to an attorney, because I was working at the Justice Center. I was the building superintendent at the Justice Center. So I'm around all these judges. You know, I have coffee with these judges every day. So I take my son to this attorney, and he said, I want $10,000 just to even take the case. I want another $10,000 if I had to walk in a courtroom. I looked at my son, and I said, you got that kind of money? He said, no, Pop. I said, well, we better go on then. But I wasn't going to give it to him. So we had to get a court-appointed attorney. I'm at work, and I'm watching this trial. Of course, I had access to closed-circuit TV to watch these trials when they're going on. And I'd sit there and watch it, and I'd cry, and I'd hurt, and I'd call my sponsor. And when the trial was over, I was on the elevator one morning with the judge that handled the case. And he said, HB, he said, I just had a boy in court here about a week ago, last name Murphy. Is any relation to you? I said, that was my son. And he just backed up and he said, you didn't come to me? Well, that's what a lot of people do. They'll go to the judge and say, you know, judge, this is my son. Can you go easy on him? He said, you didn't come to me. I said, no. How could you do that? Where'd you get the strength to do that? I wasn't going to tell him AA and Al-Anon. I said, that's what I had to do. He said, I admire you. He said, I admire somebody who's got that kind of strength. But let them take their consequences. Of course, he probated him. He was facing 10 years in prison. He probated him. And so that's what the fellowship has taught us, is that we can't enable. We can't continue to be enablers. So, you know, it's been a journey. And like I say, I'm lucky to be standing here alive. I was thinking back here a while back, I had a Navy buddy of mine that came down to visit me. some months ago, and we got to reminiscing about old Navy days. And, you know, when I got out of boot camp, I was still in my teens, and I was already full-blown alcoholic then, and they put me on a ship, and we're down in Cuba, just back in the 60s. That's back when the Cuban ordeal was going on. President Kennedy had put missiles over in Turkey looking at Russia. So the president of Russia says, well, I'll just bring some down here to Cuba and point them at the United States. So I'm on this ship down there in Cuba, and we're keeping these Russian ships from coming in there. Now, my duties, at 18 years old, I had a Thompson submachine gun and a 45. And if we seized this ship, this Russian ship, I was to board this ship and go over there and get their captain and arrest him and bring him back over. Now, I'm standing here a nut with a submachine gun, and if the thought would have hit me, like I was back in my gang days, open up on them. Open up on them, just shoot them. I mean, that's the kind of mentality I had. I could have started World War III. But like I say, I'm a walking miracle. You know, I'm living on borrowed time. But it's been a good life since I've been in sobriety. And surprisingly, today, me and my ex-wife are pretty good friends. I won't argue with her. You know, there's times she'll say, back in 1963 on Sunday afternoon, you did this. I said, well, maybe I did. Maybe I did. You see. So, I'm gonna wrap it up here, but, you know, this is our life. All of our friends are in the fellowship. We go to a lot of conferences, meet new friends. So what else is there? You know, what else is there? I stay sober one day at a time. And, you know, early in my sobriety, I thought surely somewhere down the road, there's got to be a magic year where you become drunk proof. Well, I got 36 years, and I've yet to find it. But I've seen people from 1 year or 1 year or less up to 40 years get drunk. And all I got to do is just quit working these principles in my life. And it's coming. The drink will be there to give me comfort. You know, that ease and comfort that we think that first drink's going to give us. So, I appreciate y'all having us over here, and thank you very much.